I received a letter in the post from someone who said that he was in the neighborhood last week and very much wanted to attend the shiur, but he found that all the roads leading to the shul had been blocked. Whoever wrote the letter, he didn't sign his name, but I saw the return address on the envelope was 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. So I guess that one will remain a mystery. We are just a day before Shavuos, and I thought Dovar Be'ito, Matov, to take a look at Megillas Rus. Minag Yisrael is to read this Megillah on the Shavuos, and there are many varied and different reasons that are given for this minhag. Rus was accepted Torah as the Bnei Yisrael did. She's the ancestress of David HaMelech, who was born and died on Shavuos, and numerous other reasons. There's a very interesting comment that emerges from the Gemara in Maseches Bava Basra, the end of the first perek in Daf Yud Daled. There, the Gemara discusses the various works of Tanakh, who wrote them, what the order should be. Interestingly, the order of Ksuvim, as is found in the Gemara, is not the order that we have. I'm not sure if there are halachic ramifications for what the order is, but if you open up Ksuvim, you know it will begin with Tehillim, and then Mishle, and then it keeps on going. As far as the Gemara is concerned, the order of Ksuvim should follow the chronological dating of the events of when these things happened. And therefore, it begins with the earlier works, and as it moves forward, it follows the chronological order. And that's why it actually starts with Rus, because of all of the events described or discussed or authored in Kesuvim, Rus is the first. She's already from the time of the Shoftim. David HaMelech and Shlomo are her descendants, and others yet later. But this actually begets a very interesting question, because one of the works of Ksuvim is Sefer Iyov. Now, we may know that there is a good deal of discussion as to when exactly Iyov is to be dated from. When did he live? There's even an opinion that the Iyov is a mashal, which the Gemara mentions, but there are those who understand that Iyov is already in the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, and perhaps even earlier in the time of Avraham Avinu. And therefore the Gemara raises the question, if indeed the position is, the approach is, that we wish to follow the chronological order, the first Sefer in Ksuvim should be Iyov. But it isn't. It's kind of somewhere in the middle. Why not? And the Gemara states very simply, to paraphrase, if you've ever read Sefer Iyov, you'll appreciate that you do not want to start anything with Sefer Iyov. Not Sefer Ksuvim and not anything else. Put it in the middle, put it towards the end, let everybody be happy for a while, then we'll talk about Iyov. You can't set the tone with Sefer Iyov. In the words of the Gemara, Aschule bepuranus lo maschilidan. You can't start with calamity like that. Okay, well, so we don't start with Iyov, even if chronologically he was earlier. Well, and therefore, who do we start with? The next earliest, Rus. Well, the Gemara hasn't finished, because the Gemara says, if indeed it's true that you do not open Ksuvim with calamity, well, if anyone's ever opened Megillas Rus, it opens with calamity. In Perek Aleph, it's an absolute tragedy. There's a famine in the land, and almost everyone dies in the first perek until Rus and Naomi are left. That's also Peronis. So if that's why you moved Iyov from the opening, so you should move Rus from the opening. It also starts with Peronis. And the Gemara gives an interesting and rather enigmatic response. And the Gemara says, yes, it ends with calamity, but it's Peronis de Isle Achris. It has an achris, which sounds like it has a good ending, which of course it does. Woe to the person who falls asleep in the middle of Megillah Esteros. I mean, it can ruin his entire yomtov if he never finds out that it actually ended well. So the question is, what does the Gemara mean by this? It's a Peronis, but it has a good ending. Does it mean to say, all's well that ends well? So as much as it is, begins badly, but it has a good ending, and therefore it's okay. But seemingly, it nonetheless begins badly. I mean, that hasn't changed, and we're talking about the beginning. Moreover, what makes this all the more difficult is that if you ever open up Sefer Iyov, not in the beginning, but at the end, you'll find something very interesting. The final psukim described the fact that Iyov actually ended up doing quite well. Indeed, the pasuk states, "Vashem hetiv le'Iyov achariso merishiso." Hashem has actually bestowed good to Iyov in the end, more than he had in the beginning. Which means that Iyov seems similar to Rus in this respect. It's also a calamity that has a good ending. It's also a peronus, the isla achris. In which case, we need to understand, why is it that the ending of Iyov doesn't justify or doesn't mitigate sufficiently or override the calamitous beginning, whereas the ending of Rus does? What is the difference between one peronus and another? And set against that question, let us open the Megillah. And Pasuk Aleph itself already begets questions. Pasuk Aleph reads, "Vayehi bimei shofot hashoftim." It was in the days of the judging of the judges. "Vayehi ra'av ba'aretz." There was a famine in the land. "Vayelech ish mibeis lechem Yehuda lagur b'stei Moav." Someone went from Beis Lechem to dwell in Moab. "Hu v'ishto u'shnei vanav." So the Megillah is introduced with the words "Vayehi bimei shofot hashoftim." And that actually, even on a pshat level, is rather difficult because it's so vague. Bimei shofot hashoftim, I mean, shoftim spans centuries. That tekufa, if you add up all the times of the shoftim together, decades upon decades, which means if you tell me that it was in the days of the shoftim, you've narrowed it down to a degree, but couldn't you have told me which shofet? I mean, that would have helped me even more. There are at least a dozen of them. Why then does it remain so general? It's the equivalent of beginning another sefer by saying "Vayehi bimei nevuas hanaviim," the days of the prophets. Well, that's still quite a large field. You could have narrowed it down with just a few extra words. Which navi, which melech, which shofet, as indeed is the norm for all of the other sfarim. And this really is the background for a well-known statement of Chazal in the Medrash, that shofot hashoftim is not to give us the time specifically, but rather it's more of a conceptual introduction. It describes the times. They were times of shofot hashoftim, the judging of the judges, meaning not that the judges did the judging. The judges were the judged. Dor sheshofet et shoftov. It was the generation that judged its judges. In our times, that's quite normal. People make parnasa from it. But back in the day, it's considered to be not a positive situation. So this, therefore, is bimei shofot hashoftim doesn't mean to narrow it down to a certain time per se, but to tell us what the times were like. Turbulent times. The question still persists, why do I need to have this introduction to Megillah Esteros? I mean, enough else went wrong in the beginning of the Megillah. There's a famine in the land, and Machlon dies, and Kilion dies, and Elimelech dies. And why do I also need to know that these were difficult times generally, even before the famine? As much as we get the message, why does this message find its place in the beginning of Megillah Esteros? Now, having read Pasuk Aleph, we move on to Pasuk Beis, which names those involved. V'shem ha'ish Elimelech. His name was Elimelech. V'shem ishto Naomi. His wife's name was Naomi. V'shem shnei banav, Machlon v'chilion, Ephrosim. Well, the word Ephrosim has various translations. We'll get back to that. So Pasuk Aleph begins the story. Pasuk Beis tells us who were involved. And here again, we have a very basic pshat question. And that is, it's backwards. The norm, in terms of introductions, is first that the pasuk should tell us who we're talking about, and then tell us what happened. It seems almost to have taken us back. We start the story, and then we pause for a moment. We began to say there's a famine in the land. Someone went, you know who that person was? You know what his name was? His name was Elimelech. His wife was Naomi. His two sons were Machlon and Chilion. That's the sort of information that should have really began the Megillah. By Hebrew Meshavos HaShoftim, there was a person called Elimelech, etc. and so forth. There was a famine in the land, and he went. So there seems to be a very elemental reversal just between Pasuk Aleph and Pasuk Beis, and that says Darshani. Well, there's a very interesting comment of the Medrash with regards to the relationship between Pasuk Aleph and Pasuk Beis. Most unusual. But the Medrash tells us that Pasuk Aleph and Pasuk Beis really represent two different ways of looking at Elimelech, at what he did. Two different attributes. As we know, there are two poles, the simple way of looking at them. There is Midas HaRachamim, that's the attribute of mercy, Midas HaDin, the attribute of strict justice. And the Medrash tells us that Pasuk Aleph is a benign way of looking at Elimelech and his family. In fact, it wants to cover things up. Midas HaRachamim, Mastira Aleph. It hides him, so you don't know who he is. But then comes Pasuk Beis, which is the rather more judgmental way of looking at him, and Bo Midas Hadin V'Megala Oso, and reveals him. His name was Elimelech, his wife's name was Naomi, his children's name was Machlon and Chilion, and thus you have this tension, almost, these two different perspectives, represented by the first two psukim of the Megillah. The first one wants to be nice to him. We don't know who he is. Hard to find him. And the second one tracks him down. And he's Elimelech. And that's Midas Hadin. The problem is, the contents of these two psukim do not seem to belong neither to mercy nor to judgment. Not to Midas HaRachamim, and not to Midas HaDin, as if to say, what is Pasuk Beis? It tells us his name. That's not a crime to have a name. That's not Midas HaDin. What exactly is, on the contrary, everything that went wrong is described already in Pasuk Aleph, but that's meant to be the Rachamim Pasuk. But that's not Rachamim. A wrongdoing is wrong even if the person doesn't have a name. So how exactly is that Rachamim? I mean, what are we hoping? That as long as we don't name him, so he'll get away with it. As long as he doesn't declare his name. That's not inland revenue. I mean, if he's deserving of punishment, Midas HaDin will find him. So will inland revenue, by the way. And therefore, what is this shift? The first pasuk says the crime, but no name. The second pasuk says a name, but no crime. Why is the first one the benevolent pasuk and the second one the critical pasuk? There is a very special perush on Megillas Rus, which is called Nachalas Yosef. And it was recommended already a number of years ago to me by Rav Kupperman Zatzal. He was a very beloved perush by him. And let us take a look. It's not an easy discussion because it's critical of those involved, but the psukim are there for us to learn from. What is the wrongdoing of Elimelech? I mean, what did he do wrong? It's a famine in the land, and he left. People leave. Is that a crime? Actually, it depends. The truth is, for a private citizen to leave, and even to leave Eretz Yisrael, for a private citizen, is not a crime. Strictly speaking, it's mutter. However, when it comes to someone of note, when it comes to someone in a position of authority or of influence, so then it's different. Because for him to leave, it's something of a crime against the people that he leaves behind. I mean, they're meant to look to him, and if he abandons, so then there's an indictment. Which means the very same act known as leaving Eretz Yisrael in a time of famine can either be looked upon benignly or looked upon critically, depending on who we're talking about. If he's an anonymous person, not such a problem. If he is a Baal Shem, if he is a person of note, then it becomes a problem. And now the question that we need to ask is, to which of these two categories did Elimelech belong? Can we know? Well, the Pasuk describes him as Ephratim. In Pasuk Beis, V'shemish Elimelech, V'shemish Don Na'ami, V'shem Shnei Banav, Machlem V'chilim, Ephratim. What does Ephratim mean? Well, some say Ephratim means that they're from the tribe of Ephraim, even though they were in Beis Lechem Yehuda. Okay, they may have had more than one ancestor lineage. But Rashi says that Ephratim means chashuvim. The word Ephratim means these were distinguished people. These were people of note. Well, that changes everything. Because seemingly, as soon as we discover that this family were Ephratim, then it becomes wrong for them to have left. You can't leave if you're Ephratim. You can't leave if you're Anoshim Chashuvim. It seems to be an open and shut case. However, it's still not so simple. Because we may persist and ask, what if being a person of note is not noteworthy? What if being a person of importance is a matter of no importance? What if someone is a nobleman by name, but not by position or influence? There is yet room to say that if the entire institution of nobility and of authority has lost its meaning, then so too does the responsibility that goes with belonging to such a group. Which means that we may look benignly at Elimelech for leaving. We'll say, you're such an important person. How can you stay behind? How can you leave? Well, he might respond, well, no one's important. It doesn't mean anything to be important in these times. And with that in mind, we begin to understand why the Medrash tells us that the first pasuk of the Megillah, it's Midas Harachamim. Why? Because it describes, number one, it leaves out his name. And without a name, which means that we're not aware that he's a person of great significance. But number two, this is why the Pasuk begins by saying, Vayhi bimei shafot ha-shoftim. It's not just to tell us that these were turbulent times, but rather, if we're in a time of shafot ha-shoftim, then being in a position of authority, no one really respects that. They're just judging all their judges. Whoever is in nobility is just subject to critique, and maybe worse. And therefore, Vayhi bimei shafot ha-shoftim is the case for clemency against Elimelech, because in times like that, it doesn't mean anything to be a nobleman. And he has no name. And that's why Pasuk Aleph is Midas HaRachamim. Because that act, if you take out his name, is an acceptable act. But then comes Midas HaDin, Pasuk Beis. And Pasuk Beis, in a sense, is unforgiving. It's strict justice. And Pasuk Beis says, no, he has a name. He's Elimelech. His wife is Naomi. And moreover, they are Ephratim, they're Anoshim Chashuvim. But it's a very delicate point of criticism of Elimelech, because really the Pasuk is saying, whereas he may not have enjoyed any of the, shall we say, prestige of being a significant person, he was not allowed to absolve himself of the responsibility of being in that position. He couldn't go Lekula, as if to say, no one's important anymore, and therefore I can act like a private citizen. As if to say, even though the society at large would relate to him as a private citizen, which they shouldn't have done, Midas HaDin says he is not allowed to relate to himself as such he should have taken on the responsibility, perhaps commanded respect in that way by staying. So this already is a very, we see this, it's a nuanced question, which is dealt with by these two psukim, each one in their way. Well, in the end, also Gimel tells us that Machlon dies there, and that Elimelech dies there, and Machlon and Chilion, these two sons, so they marry these two Moabite girls, Orpah and Ruth. And then they die, which is in Pasuk Hey, by Yamusu Gam Shnehem, Machlon v'Chilion. And the question that we may ask, if Elimelech, it seems that the reason why he died is as a punishment for having left, but his family left with him, and that's not yet reason for punishment, but they died as well. Well, the question is, why? And that is very closely connected to another question, which is one of the major questions of the beginning of Megillas Rus. And that is, was it acceptable for these two Jewish men, Machlon and Chilion, to marry these two Moabite girls, Rus and Orpah? And the background to that question is, are we to understand that Rus and Orpah became Jewish before marrying Machlon and Chilion, or not? Well, there are a number of places in Chazal, and this seems to be the position of Rashi, that Rus and Orpah in that initial state, they had not yet converted. The Pasuk describes them as Moabios. That's not just their origin, but that's actually still their designation at the time that they're being married. And that is the stated opinion of the Medrash and the Yalkut Shimoni, and also the Targum on Megillas Rus states that they were still not Jewish at that stage. And that's why they died. That's what the Gemara says in Bava Basra later on in Daf Tzadik Aleph Amud Beis, that they basically intermarried, which is an absolute assimilation into Moab, where they were. Now, it is true that Rus subsequently converts, but that was too late for her husband. I mean, that was after he died. She subsequently converted. And in fact, further evidence that her conversion was subsequent and not prior is a very interesting section of Gemara in Maseches Yevamos and Daf Mem Zayin, which are the dafim that deal with the halachas of Geirus. And as we know, when someone comes to convert, we don't immediately encourage them. On the contrary, in order to demonstrate that they really are sincere, they're actually discouraged. It's quite an interesting first encounter. They're told, you know, it's not so easy to be Jewish. I mean, Jewish people say that, but that's what you tell to this prospective convert. It's not so easy. There's many obligations. That idea is actually derived from Rus, because as Naomi is going back and Rus is coming with her, so Naomi is looking to dissuade her, and the pasuk, in fact, states in Pasuk Tetzayin, Ruth says, do not try and dissuade me, ki ela shetelchi eilech, wherever you go, I go. As we know the well-known Pasuk, shetelini alin, wherever you lodge, I will lodge, amech ami ve'elokayach elokai, your people is my people, your God is my God, v'ashetomusi amus v'shamaka, wherever you die, I will die and be buried there. The well-known statement of dedication from Rus. And the Gemara says in Yevamos that all of this was responses to various selected halachas that Naomi is telling Rus, you know, if you become Jewish, there are certain restrictions. She begins by saying, come Shabbos, you can't just walk wherever you want. There's a concept called Tchum Shabbos. You can't just kind of keep on walking at until further notice, but you're bound by a certain way. How does Rus respond? Asher telchi eilech, wherever you walk, I walk. It's fine. It's good enough for you. It's good enough for me. You only walk in the trum, I'll only walk in the trum. Further, Naomi says, you know, there's halachas. You can't seclude yourself if you're unmarried with another man. Says, Rus, asher talini alin. Whatever the rules are for how you sleep and who else can be there, that's good enough for me. Says Naomi, we have a lot of mitzvahs. I mean, she doesn't detail them, but she numbers them. 613 mitzvahs, says Rus, Amech, Ami. Your people are my people. The Jewish people are defined by their mitzvahs. That's how you define yourself. I'll define myself likewise. It's also to serve Avodah Zorah, which is interesting because even as a Ben Noach, Rus should be forbidden from serving Avodah Zorah, but it gets more strict. Velokayach Elokai. Your God is my God. Whatever the rules are for Avodah Zorah, that's okay. And then it gets even more strict. Naomi says, sometimes you can be Chayav Misa. If you're Jewish, the Beis Din can put you to death. Which again, is also true for Bnei Noach. But Rus says, Bashet Tamusi, Amus. Whatever the rules are for how you die, I'm prepared to follow the same rules. And therefore the Gemara sees within these expressions of Rus, she's accepting this selection of mitzvahs. A ger, in principle, accept all the mitzvahs. But the ones that we tell him about, certainly in those opening stages, doesn't have to cover all of them. But the point is, why is Naomi saying all of this to Rus now? I mean, she converted earlier on, so then she should have gone through that already. She's Jewish now. Now is not the time to tell her what it means to become Jewish. She's already become Jewish. That seems to indicate quite clearly that the point that Rus was becoming Jewish was now. And therefore she needs to have the introduction of Geirus with the accompanying words of dissuasion. That is the representation of one school of thought from Chazal, and again, accepted by Rashi. However, there does seem to be another school of thought. For the Rambam quotes a Gemara in Bava Basra, actually Tzadik Aleph Amud Aleph. There seems to be a bit of a machlokas between two sides of the same page in Gemara, a lot in between. Because the Gemara says there, it talks about leaving Eretz Yisrael in a time of famine, and the Gemara says, in a Machlon and Chilion, that's why they died. They shouldn't have left Eretz Yisrael. Now, to see the way the Rambam expresses this, in Hilchot Melachim, in Perek Hay, Halachates, Rambam says, Asur lateis me'eretz Yisrael lechutz la'aretz la'olam. One's not allowed stam to leave Eretz Yisrael for chutz la'aretz. There are famous exceptions to get married or to learn Torah, etc. If he needs it for parnasa. But stam to leave? No. Ela im kein chazak sham hara'av. Unless there's a famine. Listen, if it's a famine, so you can leave. But then says Rambam, "Va'afal pi shemutar latzeis, even though it's mutar to leave if there's a famine, ein amidas chasidus. It's not considered to be an act of piety. And if you're a chassid, you'll stay even if there's a famine. It's not the best. Shari machlon vechilion. Consider," says Rambam, "machlon and chilion shnei gedolei hador hayu." I mean, that's those are words in appreciation of machlon vechilion. Shnei gedolei hador. I don't know how many other people the Rambam called gedolei hador in the Mishnah Torah. They were two great people in generation. Umebeitzara gedolei yotzu. And they left due to very pressing circumstances. And it didn't help. V'nischayvu kloya lamokom. And they still were deserving of being destroyed. So it's interesting because the way the Rambam presents it, it almost sounds like they were such gedolim and still it didn't help. But the irony is, it's because they were gedolim that they got into so much trouble. If they weren't such gedolim, they were just normal people, so then it wouldn't have been such a problem. But presumably the Rambam is saying that even as gedolim, if they got such harsh punishment, it means it's not midas chasidus for anyone to leave. The point is, if the Rambam has identified the reason for the demise of Machlon and Chilion, that they left Eretz Yisrael in a time of famine, which is a contravention of Midas Chassidus, it sounds like there were no more pressing issues over which perhaps they would have been punished. For example, intermarriage. In other words, from the way the Rambam is expressing it, it really sounds like the worst thing they did during that time, which incurred the liability of death, was that they left Eretz Yisrael. That's not an act of piety. It sounds like everything else was in order, which really, therefore, in turn, sounds as if Rus and Orpah were actually Jewish. They converted prior to the marriage. And this is also the opinion, famously, of the Ibn Ezra in his Perush to Megillas Rus. And in fact, Ibn Ezra says, that's why when Orpah leaves, she kind of loses her steam a little bit and she leaves. So Naomi says, look at Orpah, maybe you should follow her. Hine shava yivimtech elamava eloheha. She's returned to her nation and to her deities. Maybe you should follow her as well. So the Ibn Ezra says, if going back to that way of living is called returning, it sounds like she's returning from being somewhere else because she was Jewish and then she revoked it or rescinded it in that way. Good. So the question is, or among the questions are, if indeed it's true that Rus and Orpah were actually Jewish, it's very difficult to then understand why Naomi is trying to persuade them to go back to Moab. It's one thing to say when a person comes to be Jewish, so you say, yeah, you sure you want to get involved? Maybe you should just kind of stay non-Jewish, might be easier for you. But once they become converted, right, so that's irrevocable. Certainly, it's not the sort of thing you'd recommend. Once they're Jewish, they're Jewish. And then to say go back, so that actually would seem to be a corroboration of the fact that they weren't Jewish. Otherwise, how can Naomi try and persuade either of them to go back? And she keeps on going. So these are the two, in a sense, primary approaches. And it's either a yes or no. In other words, they either converted or they hadn't converted. But there seem to be, in a sense, lingering questions for both. But there is a third school of thought. And it's more, there's a basis in the Zohar Chadash, but it's really developed in the parish of the Bach, the Bais Chadash, the famous Bach on the tour. He has a parish, two parishim actually, on Megillas Rus, and he develops a certain idea, and others take his approach and then have their own variations on it, etc. Rav Waldenberg in the Tzitz Eliezer and Chelek Yud Zayin has a lengthy tshuva about this very question. And in a sense, the Bach wishes to make reach a middle ground, as if to say, it's possible that indeed there was some form of conversion prior to them being married. However, as we know, it's possible, I mean, there are requirements for conversion. It has to be sincere, it has to be for the right reasons, and it has to be with the acceptance of all that goes with being Jewish. Some conversions are rather suspect in that respect, especially those that have a marriage involved. Because there's a very good chance that that's what the conversion is all about. It's a conversion in name, but not in content. And it's clear that no one had ever really spoken to Rus or Orpah about what it means to be Jewish in terms of keeping mitzvahs. Naomi, therefore, has strong reason to suspect that the original gerus, which was done perhaps for purposes of marriage, without really accepting what a person needs to accept in order to become Jewish. In fact, interestingly, and Rav Waldenberg adds this as a parenthetical comment, but it's a very important point, no one knew at the time that the ban against someone from Moab marrying into the Jewish people only applied to the males. That is well known to us now. Moavi velo Moavis. Amoni velo Amonis. That was not a well-known halacha at the time. And the reason, very simply, is because no one Jewish had ever married anyone from Moab. I mean, in terms of the range, Moab was off the list. Which means that this halacha, if you needed to get smicha to be part of the Sanhedrin, you didn't really need to know this. It would never happen. So 300 years or whatever had passed, and this halacha fell into disuse. I mean, it just wasn't known. And indeed, Boaz had to reestablish it before he married Ruth. But the common notion at the time was Moabi means anyone from Moab. And that already raises a major question mark about the acceptance of mitzvahs, because it seems the of Rus and Orpah to Machlon and Chilion was in contravention of an Aveira, as far as people knew. And therefore, what Naomi is looking to do is really to, in a sense, test the mettle of the original Geirus. And that is why she begins to talk to them about mitzvahs. And then what happens is Orpah, who goes home, in going home, she demonstrates that that she never really signed up for Judaism in a way that involves mitzvahs. In which case, it then became clear that from the outset, her gerus was flawed. She's not interested when she finds out what it means to be Jewish. Rus is, and therefore at this point, Rus's gerus, in a sense, is confirmed. Perhaps one could say even retroactively, because she was always prepared for the mitzvos. And therefore, in a sense, on the one hand, Machlon and Chilion, they converted Rus and Orpah after a fashion, but in a rather suspect way. But that still leaves room for Naomi to try and test them in a way and see exactly whether the gerus was genuine. There is, I think, it's a kind of a tragic point in a way. And that is that the two discussions that we've had so far, namely leaving Eretz Yisrael, the propriety of, or the acceptability of leaving Eretz Yisrael in a time of famine, and marrying Rus and Orpah, they intersect on this point. Namely, are we to lay emphasis on what has formally happened or what has actually happened? And I think at this point, Machlon and Chilion, they got caught because they, in a sense, they contradicted their own approach, as if to say, originally, Elimelech and his family leave Eretz Canaan, Eretz Yisrael. How can they leave? Are they not Ephrasim? Are they not known as noble people? What is their response? It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything to be noble. We are essentially not noble. On paper, formally, we're noble people. But tachlis, it doesn't mean anything. Which that means that they're open to the notion that sometimes something can exist as a formality, but tachlis, it doesn't mean anything. That is the indictment of their conversion of Rus and Orpah, because they only really converted formally, but not with the content that's required. And if you left Eretz Yisrael based on content and not form, then you will be indicted for marrying women who are only Jewish in form and not in content. I think that's how these two points intersect with each other. Well, time passes, and Rus and Naomi hear, after Rus, well, they all hear, all three of them, that the famine has abated, and Naomi is looking to make her way back to Eretz Yisrael, and she then begins to have these discussions with Rus and Orpah as to whether they should follow her. Orpah, at a certain point, although to her credit, initially she's with Rus, she wants to stay, but she gets worn out by Naomi and she leaves. And when she leaves, she doesn't go back to particularly moral way of living. But Rus stays with her. And this is a very important point in the Megillah, because Rus's decision to stay with Naomi, it's not just a decision to become Jewish. She can become Jewish and go and be anonymous somewhere in the country. It's to stay with Naomi. The Medrash tells us and says this about Megillas Rus, makes a point of saying this, that there aren't really many halachas that we learn from Rus. Maybe one or two, but it's not there to teach us halachas. What it's there to teach us is the outstanding reward for Gemilas Hasadim, the kindness that Rus showed to Naomi. And look what happened to her in the end. That's what the Megillah was written for, to teach you the reward for Gemilas Chasadim. And that kindness happens here, because Rus's will, her iron will to stay with Naomi, because she knows that Naomi needs it, has to withstand like an onslaught of rejection, essentially, from Naomi. Firstly, Naomi just dissuades them generally. She basically said they have everything waiting for them if they go back home, because they were descended from royalty in Moab. So they'll have riches, and they can marry well, and they can live a comfortable life. If you come with me, life will be difficult in basically every single respect. I've got no money, and no one's going to marry you, because you're from Moab, and the first two people that tried died. And socially, no one's really going to mix with you. So that's the first thing. That's just to have the, put the two options before them, coming back to Eretz Yisrael versus going back to Moab. And then she thanks them. which is very interesting, as the Nachlas Yosef says, that's an interesting, in a sense, psychological point. Because what she's saying is, she kind of kisses them goodbye and says thank you. That's a way of saying the conversation is over. She doesn't give them an opening to respond. She says, Hashem should bless you. She gives them brachas, right? Yitein Hashem lachem menucha. Or even before that, Yas Hashem imachem chesed kasher sisem emameisim amadi. Hashem should be kind to you as you were kind to me. Yitein Hashem lachem menucha isha beis isha. You should find a good shidduch back in Moab. That's a way of saying goodbye. It's very difficult to argue with that unless you're not saying goodbye, taking goodbye for an answer, so to speak. But then, Naomi says more than that in terms of her dissuasion. Because they say, no, we wish to come with you. Pasuk Yud, Batamarnula, no, we're coming back. Ki itach nashuv la'amech. And then, Naomi says, firstly, no one's going to marry you. And then at the end of Pasuk Yud Gimel, she says, Ki marli ma'od mikem. It's very bitter for me, from you. That's very interesting. You know, at this point, Naomi is saying on some level, not just that it'll be difficult for you, generally, but it's difficult for me to have you here. Because it's almost like the only thing worse than going back by myself is going back with you. Because if I go back by myself, how do they remember me? That's Naomi. Okay, she used to have be married to Elimelech. She had two sons. They died. That's tragedy. Here she is, all by herself. The only thing worse than that is coming back with the two Moabite girls who her sons were married to. That's going to make it worse. That's what she says to them. Marli ma'od mikem. You will make things bitter for me. That's very difficult to break through that a statement like that. Because on a certain level, if you want to help, basically, you know what I'm saying? If you really want to help, go home. And at that point, Orpah breaks. And Rus keeps going. And really what Rus is saying is that she's not prepared to accept that this is true, which means it may be true on a certain level, but on a much deeper level, Naomi really does need her, and therefore she's prepared to be told to her face to go away, and I don't want you here, and you'll make my life more difficult for me, and basically ignore that. And lahavdil, but sometimes it's like that, when one can, in a sense, the chitzonius, on a certain external level, the person who needs help, lahavdil, says you're only making it worse. And you just have to crack through that because inside, no, they really do need your help. But you've got to be very persistent because it's unpleasant. And that is the kindness. That's the depth of the kindness of Rus towards Naomi. And Gila was written. And from that comes all of the greatness of Rus. And in a sense, therefore, this brings us to the difference between Rus and Iyov, with which we began. In terms of a classification, they both begin badly and end well. Rus begins badly, famine in the land, people die, it ends well, Ima shel Malchus. So does Iyov. Iyov begins, well, more than begins, a lot of Iyov is difficulty, but it ends well. And yet the Gemara said, you can start with Rus, but you can't start with Iyov. Why? Because Rus has a bad beginning, but it has a good ending. Peronus to Isle Achris. Whereas Iyov doesn't have a good ending. But it does have a good ending. So what's the difference between them? But rather, says the Nachlas Yaakov, the difference is that if you have a bad beginning and a good ending, the bad beginning is still bad. If you're looking for how to open, it's still a bad opening. The fact that in the end it was okay, but the beginning is where the focus is. But the point is, with Rus, how the way that things ended up was a result of the calamitous beginning. In other words, the achris, it didn't just succeed the calamity. It was produced by the calamity. In other words, had there never have been this very, very tragic situation, the greatness of Rus would never have been activated, would never have been accessed, had she never been in this terrible situation where everything good is waiting for back home, nothing is good waiting for with Nami, Nami's all alone, etc. and so forth. So without the pureness that led to that situation, the depth of her kindness would never really have been accessed. And therefore, what the Gemara is saying is the good ending of Rus, it was a product of the pureness. And therefore, we look at the pureness differently. We don't look upon this as a bad beginning anymore. We look upon it as a tough beginning. But this was the beginning that begat the ending. In contrast with Eov. Because as far as we know, Eov, in a sense, he was, so to speak, compensated for all the suffering that he had. Hashem gave him more in the end than he ever had in the beginning. But there is no notion that everything good that happened to him was because of the suffering that he went through. So until further notice, one needs to ponder it and plumb the depths of, say, for Eov, etc. But on the face of it, that's a bad beginning and remains so. You don't want to start Kesuvim that way. But you do start Kesuvim with Rus. Even the beginning looks different when you see what it led to. And the course of the history of the Jewish people only became what it became as a result of the pureness of Rus. It's a very demanding, in a sense, very challenging, I would say, thing to say. Because really, it's an expression about often pureness. We don't wish for pureness. We don't wish for difficult times. But it is often true that there is a certain level that people reach, and a certain levels of kindness and of heroism and of going beyond themselves that would have lain dormant and untapped, etc., were not for those things. And that's a very important message, of course, which needs a great deal of reflection. And there is a further point with regards to Ruth here and the way that she relates to Naomi. There is a pasuk in Tehillim which states, Matsasi David Avdi. And Matsasi David Avdi, I think it's in Pei Zayin or Pei Tes. Beshemin Kachim Mishavtim. I found David. So, the question is there room to ask, where did you find him? What does it mean you found him? Or where was he that you found him? We probably wouldn't ask such a question. Except the Medrash asked that question. So now we would ask that question. If you have a good answer, it's a good question. So the Medrash says, "V'heichad matzasiv." Where'd you find him? Matzasi David Avdi. Says the Medrash, "B'sedom." I found him in Sedom. Now that is harder than the question. But what does it mean that Hashem found David in Sedom? Well, as we know from a certain point of view, the roots of David were partially in Sedom, in the sense that he comes from Moab. Moab, that is, because he comes from Rus, and Rus comes from Moab, and Moab came from Lot and his two daughters who were in Sedom. And in fact, when Lot is told, and this is the pasuk where the Medrash comments, he's told to take his two daughters, Shnei Brasecha, Hanimtzaos. There's a find here. Take them out. There's a find here. Who's being found here? David is being found here. But of course, the question is, as true as it is perhaps historically, that there was a time when, you know, his ancestors was in Sedom. But what does that mean to say that David was found in Sedom? How was David found in Sedom? Well, what Moab represents, and more than Ammon actually, what Moab represents really is the trait of chutzpah. And in fact, the very name Moab is a name of chutzpah. It's an irreverent name. It shows no shame, no values. Moab means from the father. I mean, that's not the most discreet way to name your child, right? Because it was her with Lot, and Moab doesn't care. And Moab therefore represents a certain trait of brazenness and of chutzpah, essentially. Well, interestingly, there is a town that really is very closely associated with the trait of chutzpah, and that is Sodom. What is the chutzpah of Sodom? We know that Sodom is a town, we know that they're a town of selfishness. But in what way are they a town of chutzpah? They're a town of chutzpah because they took all that cruelty and they put it into the constitution That's a chutzpah, as if to say, to take something that is criminal, to take cruelty and to lord it as a moral value, that's already an absolute overturning of any type of value system. You need a certain chutzpah to do that. If you have shame, so you'll be cruel and not get rewarded for it. A place that rewards cruelty is an absolute abdication of any type of value. And that's why, as the Mefarshim say, when Sodom was destroyed, it was overturned. Ma'apechas Sodom. It was overturned because they had overturned everything. They had literally turned good into evil, evil into good. And that's what Sodom was all about. From a certain point of view, this gives us a deeper appreciation of how Lot found his way to Sodom. It wasn't just that there was good pasture there. I mean, that's a hard, a steep price to pay for good pasture. But he was attracted to this. He was attracted to this midah of chutzpah, in a sense. And indeed, for his troubles, he became the judge of Sodom. I mean, it was destroyed on the first day, which wasn't so good, for his resume. But he became the judge of Sodom because they saw like a natural talent in Sodom. And that's got to be destroyed. However, it can't be completely destroyed. And the reason why is because there is something about chutzpah that if it's only used in the right way, is actually very necessary. Because chutzpah is the ability, in a sense, to perhaps stare down certain norms or mores. And it can be enlisted in the service of that which is right. And certainly, if there's ever an individual who needs, in a sense, chutzpah, he needs to be chutzpahdik, at least in the sense of being forthright, of being firm, regardless perhaps of public opinion. That's a king. A king is only really a leader if he's prepared to do what's right in the face of perhaps other people that may think he's wrong or whatever. And that's why the Medrash says, when the Pasuk says, Matsasi David Avdi, I found David. The Medrash says, where do you find him? I mean, look what David did. I mean, he's conquering on behalf of the Jewish people. That's a certain type of chutzpah. If you want to be nice to everyone, you stay at home. Where'd you find him? In Sodom. In other words, there was a kernel of what was led to the corruption of Sodom, which actually is necessary for a good king. And that's why, in a sense, David was found in Sodom. That midah needed to be refined and sublimated and purified and elevated until it became kosher enough to become an asset for the Jewish people with the king at their head. But indeed it was. And interestingly, the one who injected that into the Jewish people was Rus. In other words, Rus, from a certain point of view, she enlisted this very kosher kind of chutzpah in order to make her way into the Jewish people, in order to make her back with Naomi. Because Naomi is basically telling her to leave. And she's basically telling her, I don't want you here, etc. And she's her mother-in-law. We shouldn't forget. And there's a certain way you're meant to talk to your mother-in-law. And a certain way you're not meant to talk to her. And Rus, in a very delicate way, employs the trait of chutzpah. And tells her to stop telling her to leave. You're not meant to. But she did. You're wasting your time. I'm not leaving. And I don't care what you say. I mean, that's basically what she's saying. And that temerity was her greatest asset. And the truth of the matter is that without that, she never would have converted. Forget about being with Naomi. She never would have converted to Judaism. She would have gone with the flow. The flow would have led her back to Moab. She seemed to be having good prospects with Machlon and Chilion. They died. Nothing else is happening. Nothing's going on back in Israel for her. So she should go back to Moab. In fact, there's a very interesting Medrash which notes that Megillas Rus comprises of 85 psukim. And almost all of them begin with the letter Vav, the very, very high concentration of psukim that begin with Vav. There are almost no exceptions, but there are exceptions. In fact, there are 8 exceptions. Of the 85 psukim, says the Medrash, 8 of them do not begin with Vav. And the Medrash says that really reflects Rus, those 8 psukim. Why? Because she joined the Jewish people who entered the Bris on the 8th day. So the Shaila is, how do the psukim without a Vav represent Rus? I mean, with a Vav, without a Vav, it's all Hebrew. Rav Shlomo HaLevi Alkabetz, famous as the author of Lecha Dodi, has a perush on Megillas Rus called Shoresh Yishai. And Rav Alkabetz says something truly wonderful. The letter Vav really represents the natural flow of events. It's just this happened and this happened. I mean, the Vavs are the hooks that basically lead one thing lead to the other. And that is life for the most part, and for many people. In a sense, what Rus did was that she broke with the letter Vav, as if to say, if one thing had just led to another, everything would have led Rus back home. So she's swimming upstream as she becomes Jewish. And that's represented by her psukim, or the 8 psukim that don't have a Vav. I mean, she's breaking the natural chain of events. And on the contrary, the mitzvah of Mila, of course, on the 8th day, again, it's something above and beyond what nature, how a person naturally is. And that's why those are her psukim. And what do we say after all this? It gives us a deeper insight into the appellation that is given to Rus. She's called Ima Shel Malchus. She's the mother of royalty. Mother of royalty doesn't just mean that in terms of lineage, the king was descended from her. David HaMelech was her great-grandson, and she's his great-grandmother, so she's the mother of royalty. It's more than a familial thing. She's the mother of royalty in the sense that she brings royalty, this aspect of royalty, into the Jewish people. She is the one that brought that. She sanitized the trait of chutzpah, which was the specialty of Moab, used in an unhealthy way. She koshered it, and she brought it into the Jewish people. David HaMelech needs that. So do his descendants, so does any king, and certainly so does the future. And the Mashiach himself will be coming from David, Mashiach ben David, who comes from Rus. So these are certain perspectives. Again, when we read Megillas Rus on Shavuos morning, I'm not sure that that time would be aptly termed as peak awareness. And it's for that reason, all the more it behooves us to have a look at these things, to see through the Mefarshim, Chazal, Rishonim, and Achronim, to share some perspectives on this very special Megillah. We'll meet again in Mitz Hashem next week. In the meanwhile, wish you all a good Yom Tov, a Sameach, and all the best.